continuing with the seminar on the basics of philosophy. And we are trying to be universal in this, and that we will include references to philosophy as it is understood in the West. But we want to keep in focus our Vaishnava philosophy, so correlate the forms of philosophy that people in the West struggle with and see how these problems are actually answered by our Bhagavata philosophy. So as I said yesterday, today we shall talk about the big fancy word, epistemology, which we can turn into this phrase: how can we know the truth? Philosophy is a search for the truth. So epistemology is investigating whether that's possible. Is it possible for human beings to know the truth? And if it is possible, then how? By what means? What is the appropriate means to know the truth? So you'll recall yesterday I spoke of this Kali Yuga philosophy, modernism, postmodernism, philosophy of today, how it is dependent upon basically two things, physical forces, and then numerical value. And I told you that these have been in vogue, you know, these have been primary sources of knowledge for quite a long time in the West, since the ancient cultures that were based on sacrifice, as seen in Egypt, Mesopotamia, they collapsed. People no longer wanted to follow priests, sacrificial priests and kings. So they began to rely, what? On the knowledge of the Vaishyas and Shudras. So this concern for physical forces is a concern of the Shudra mentality. What do Shudras do? They work. So working means to move around physical things. It requires physical force. So the Shudras are concerned with physical forces and numerical value. That is a concern of the Vaishyas. So therefore, what we call modern philosophy today is mainly drawing its epistemology, its tools of knowledge, from this, from the worldview of the Shudras and the Vaishyas. This is what makes up science. Science is just this. It's a study of physical forces, physics, chemistry, and then it has to be arranged according to some type of logics, some type of system. And that's done according to numerical value or mathematics. So that's modern science. It's the business of Vaishyas and Shudras. And we can relate also this is important, to relate this to what we call praman. Praman means evidence in Sanskrit. So there is pratyaksha praman. And anuman. These are two pramans. Of course, we have one more, but I just wanted to ask you, do you know the meaning of these terms? What means, yes, pratyaksha?
Systematically, you come to the answer.
Nope.
Anuman is speculative.
Well, let's deal with pratyaksha. What is pratyaksha mean? Sense perception. Yes. And anuman
means, as you've said, mental speculation. So this is what we have in our modern epistemology, Western epistemology, is pratyaksha, referring to this, physical forces, the shudra concerns. And then anuman, the workings of the mind, logical workings of the mind, referring ultimately to numerical value. So of course, we know, and I'm going to explain this later, but we know that in our Vaishnava philosophy, there is another praman, which is
shabda,
which means the spiritual sound. And that is the real praman. Prabhupada said this in a conversation with some philosophers in Mexico City, a philosopher and a scientist. He said, actually, that's the real praman. And these other two, they are dependent upon that shabda praman. So in Vaishnava philosophy, we also use pratyaksha and anuman, but never independently of shabda. It can never be independent. If someone tries to make an argument based on what I saw or what I think, which differs from the statement of Shastra, boom, we kick them right out the door. We don't want to talk to them because that is nonsense. And what I want to do in this seminar, this session today, is explain exactly why it's nonsense. This is not just a dogmatic statement. I'm going to show you how, if this is your only reference, your only evidence, your only epistemology, then you run into absurdity. Mm-hmm. It reduces to absurdity. This is now. I want to introduce you to another very important term: reductionism. This is important to understand how modern science and philosophy works. So, reductionism, as this word will naturally indicate, it means to reduce something down. So, our experience as human beings, according to the epistemology of today, is reduced to this: physical forces and numerical value. That is what is considered to be real. You see? That's reality. But obviously, there is more to our human life than this. For example, I'll give an example that Srila Prabhupada gave. He said when he was still in grihastha life in Calcutta, he had the experience of seeing some place, I forget exactly where, but anyway, there was a Muslim man. Muslims are meat eaters. So a Muslim man in Calcutta, he was killing a chicken. And he was like this Magrari type of butcher. He only cut the neck half. He didn't cut the head completely off. He just cut it half off. And so the chicken was running around in a frenzy, and blood was squirting out everywhere. So the man was watching this, and he was laughing. But his son, little son, was there. And the son was crying. The small boy was crying to see this. He thought it was horrible. And Prabhupada saw the man was saying, "Why are you crying? This is very nice to see." So Prabhupada's point, and I touched on this morning in the Bhagavatam class, as Srila Prabhupada explained this, he said that there is, it was evident in that boy, an innocent spirit. So that although the boy is born in a Muslim family, which is considered very low class from the Vedic point of view, because he was small and innocent, and therefore, naturally, spontaneously, seeing a chicken being killed in that way and suffering was to him terrible. Now, where does that sense come from? You can't explain that by referring to the physical forces and numerical value. Why a child would find a scene like that horrible? Or another example from one travel book about India. I think it's very similar to this first example. that a Western man was traveling through India, and he wrote a book about his experiences. So in one place, he saw a market, an open market, where fish were for sale. The fish were being kept in tins, and they were swimming around in these tins. So he was just passing through, looking at everything, and he noticed a Brahmana man and his little daughter were also coming through the marketplace. And so the little daughter, small innocent girl, she stopped before these tins and she saw the fish. And the Western man was remarking that it seemed that this is the first time the girl had seen fish. So she was fascinated. And she was looking at the fish and holding her father's hand. And then she was asking her father, "What is this?" And the father was saying, "Oh, these are fish from the river." And then she said, "Well, why do they keep them in these tins?" And he replied, "Oh, these people, they're going to eat them." And as soon as she heard that, she began to cry. Her eyes became filled with tears, and she felt so sad for these little fish. So again, where does that come from? And you can't explain that by this type of value system. I can also think of, and this will bring us up to the point, an experience I had when I was going on Sankirtan in the States, book distribution. So we were, myself and some other boys were arrested. We were in, it was a vacation place on the seacoast in the state of Massachusetts. Is a region called Cape Cod, which is very high class. And so it's very crowded in the summer, but it's strictly policed because, you know, kind of wealthy people go there and they don't want to be bothered too much by people like us. So we would go there anyway because the book distribution was very good, but you had to always deal with these policemen. So we got arrested and we had to appear in the court the next day. So while we were sitting in the courtroom waiting for our case to be called before the judge, there was another fellow who came up on the dock in the front, and he was charged with creating a disturbance, see, disturbing the public peace. So as it was presented before the judge, he was standing on the street corner playing a harmonica. He was a far-out guy with real long hair and beard. So he was playing a harmonica, and the policeman came up to him and said, "You can't do that. You can't stand here in one place and play harmonica. You're blocking the traffic and creating a disturbance. You have to move on." So instead of moving on, what this young man did was, there was a park bench, which is city property, park bench nearby, and he jumped up on that. And he began to dance a jig and play the harmonica even louder. So then the policeman arrested him. So then the judge asked this musical man, "Why did you do that? Why, when the policeman came to you and said, you know," he wasn't going to arrest you then, he just said, "You move on. But you did this illegal act, jumping on city property and playing even more. Why did you do that?" So then the young man, he began to offer an explanation. It was a pseudo-scientific explanation based on this kind of stuff. He was saying, "Well, you see, the molecules that make up my body are in a positive state, and the molecules making up the policeman's body were in a negative state. So when we came together, there was a repulsion." And like he was saying, I was just reacting by physical forces, you see. By physical force, I was placed up on top of the park bench and playing even harder. So he was trying to say that, because it was all just the unfolding of material nature, therefore he's not responsible and the judge should let him go. But the judge didn't let him go. So you can see from these examples in our practical life, in our human life, things, important things in life, do not reduce down to physical forces and numerical value. You see, if that was the only praman, the only evidence of anything true, and we actually lived according to that, then I think, you know, our life would be, as human beings, very strange. It would be totally unrecognizable. You couldn't recognize it as a human life. You see, about the only things that really live according to these two values or these two evidences are, you know, things like viruses, things like that, which drift through the atmosphere. The viruses are, they hardly show any life symptoms, only when they just drift along, moved by physical forces, and when they come next to a living cell, then they get attached to it, and then there's some mechanical reaction where they take over that cell. So a virus is one of the most primitive forms of life. So we may say that they live pretty much according to physical forces and numerical relationships, but human life could not go on that way. So this is the interesting situation, is that modern epistemology tries to impose these values of physical forces and numerical values upon everything. This is reductionism. It tries to reduce everything down to this and say that only this is real. You see? So, we have other values. I'll mention them. These are Vaishnava values. For example, mercy, honesty, daya, arjava, compassion, purity, and then finally the devotional sentiment. Or bhakti. These values are very, very important. They're very, very important. But according to this reductionism, they're ultimately not real. You see? They say they're subjective, they're just in your mind. They're not actually real. This is what's real. So, this, reducing everything to physical forces and numerical value, this is what they call facts. Facts are made up of that. You see? And so the modern epistemology, ultimately, to make everything very simple, means facts. Now, what are facts? Okay. So facts, the word fact, comes from a Latin word, facio, which means to make or to do. So a fact is something that is made by men. You see? Even this, pratyaksha anumana, you see, our sense perceptions are there through our physical senses, our human senses. What we're perceiving is, in a sense, made by our senses, in a sense. And also what we think in our minds, that is a product of our human mentality. So this is what are facts, that which is made by men. And therefore, facts are, the great concern of facts is practicality. Facts are practical. You see? Now, when you refer your facts back to physical forces and numerical value, when you say this is what constitutes facts, you see, and facts are practical, what you're coming to is mechanism. This is what becomes knowledge. This is what becomes truth. mechanism. You see? This physical forces plus numerical value, from these two you get machines. So the modern epistemology, the way to knowledge today, looks for machinery. And that is the truth. And that is science. You see, wherever it can find machinery, see, looking at the human being, so there's this physical body. And obviously there's much biological machinery in this physical body. So that's the fact. That's the truth. And therefore this stuff must be dependent upon that. It's some kind of, they have this fancy word, epiphenomenon. It means it's some kind of, you know, product. It's some kind of subtle product of this mechanism, the biological mechanism. So this is where you get this idea of consciousness arising from matter, you see. Consciousness comes from the brain, you see, and then mercy, honesty, compassion, these are all coming out of the brain. So now, the moral result of that, if you accept mechanism as the factual truth, the actual reality, practicality, a mechanism, then this is what's interesting. I wonder if I can... Can this be moved to a new page? Then what happens is that can becomes more important than should. This is very, very important to understand. Just like beef, cow flesh, it can be eaten. So when you reduce everything down to physical forces and numerical values, to mechanism, then what the hell is wrong with eating beef? Huh? Why you crazy Hindus don't eat beef? What's wrong with you? It's practical. I mean, beef is factually food. What's wrong with it? You see? This is reductionism. It narrows knowledge down so that morality is left out. Huh? Questions of right and wrong no longer matter, or they matter only on the side. They're side issues. What's important is what can be done. Huh? What can be done by mechanical arrangements. So, beef can be eaten. Huh? Now, you say it shouldn't be eaten, but that, you know, that's not important. There's no mechanical explanation for why beef can't be eaten. Where's the physics of it? You see? You can't explain that in terms of physical forces and numerical value. So that's just your opinion. But the reality is beef can be eaten. So then you see the whole morality, what is good, it becomes drastically changed when we accept this epistemology. Good becomes whatever can be done. That's good. And that's progress. So beef can be eaten, and abortions can be performed, and contraceptives can be used, and bombs can be dropped. All of these things can be done. And, you know, why not? Mechanistically speaking, why not? So then, we come to the next point about progress. The idea of progress becomes progress in efficiency. More effective ways of doing things. You want to cook? Well, the most effective way, ergo, the best way to cook is to use a microwave oven. Huh? Because it gets the job done in 5 minutes. That's the most effective. That's progress. You see? The best way to do things. And this is modern society. It's like that. So that means, and this is very important for us as devotees to understand, that means future time is good. The past is bad. You see? Whatever happened in the past, 50 years ago, 100 years, what to speak of 5,000 years ago? That's some impoverished Africa of the human condition. The people were very, very primitive then. They didn't have microwave ovens. They didn't have contraceptives. They were suffering like anything. But, you know, now and the future, that is good. The future will bring better and better things because that is progress. So you see, progress, which is important, which is very important to us as devotees. Srila Prabhupada speaks of human progress, but it's a whole different concept of progress. Here, progress just means the, you know, mechanical movement of time. Huh? Time into the future. And whatever time brings, that's good. This goes together with the doctrine of evolution. Evolution is just an expression. Actually, it's a very natural philosophical conclusion from everything I've shown you. So evolution is a doctrine, a religious belief, which comes out of this epistemology. Evolution is nowhere been proved, you see. They talk so much about proof, again referring to physical things and numerical values, but they haven't proved evolution by that at all. It's just an idea, but this idea fits well with this epistemology. So therefore, it's the holy doctrine today. So future time good, past time, and this all gets into so many things. Their ideas of the universe is self-productive. The universe created itself, you see. This was the first invention. The universe itself. And therefore, the human purpose is to be defined in that way, as inventing, you see. We should just make machines. That's our purpose, you see. And if we're making machines and better machines, well, then we're progressing. You see, life is getting better. And it's all automatic. It's time is... You know, time is God in this in this conception. The passage of time is God. It's bringing us closer and closer to the day when we will realize ourselves as God after we have remade everything, you see, mechanically. So, oh yes, now we come to the great irony. Now I've built all this up. Now I'm going to tear it down. I said I'm going to show you that it's nonsense. So we've just come to that point. This point about future time good, past time is bad. Well, the big irony here is that facts, remember what facts means? Facts means our human perception and our human thoughts. Facts exist always in the past. Just like, of course, today, and on many days here in Denmark, you don't see the sun, because it's such an auspicious place here. But when you can see the sun, what are you seeing? You're not seeing the sun as it is. According to science, it takes 8 minutes for the light of the sun to come here. So we're always seeing the sun in the past. It takes time for, through this mechanism of the body and the subtle mechanism of the mind, it takes time for us to become aware of what's going on around us. And in that time, the actual reality changes. So we're always behind the reality in this sense. That's the meaning of the word phenomenal. Phenomenal means that as soon as you know it, it's already changed. So, by this very epistemology, we are never in touch with reality. And facts are out of touch with reality. So this is the great irony here. And it's quite humorous. So what we are calling facts, or facts as a substitute for truth, is dead information. You see? It's information that we're becoming aware of, but as we're becoming aware of it, the reality that this information refers to has already changed. So the information is actually dead. You see? And so, therefore, Srila Prabhupada, we find in his books this nice term, shushka jnana, which means dry knowledge. This whole type of knowledge is dry. It's dealing only with dead things. That is a fact. So we're not in touch with reality at all. We're just in touch with dead information. And that information is extremely limited. Because, as we said, it depends on the senses. So, our position is like that prasadam prayer, sharira vijaja, which speaks of the network of the senses. So a spider lives in a network. A very good analogy. A spider, here's a little spider, and he lives in a web. So this is his field of knowledge. That term is used in Bhagavad Gita, the Kshetra, the field of knowledge. There's the field of knowledge and the knower of the field. So the soul can be compared, the soul in his body can be compared to a spider. And the web is our network of sense perception and also the reasoning that is associated with sense perception. So a spider, as science, well, biologists tell us, the spider's own sensory powers are very, very limited. Spiders don't have good eyesight. They don't have good hearing. Their senses are very, very dull, except for one, the sense of touch. They're very sensitive in that sense. And so they sit on their web, their legs are touching different strands of the web. And if something, a fly, gets caught in the web, then just by the vibration traveling along the strand of the web, the spider knows immediately what is there. He can tell by the vibrations this is a fly. He can tell where it is in the web, how far away, and he goes right there. Otherwise, the spider is pretty much blind and deaf and dumb. But by feeling, he can move around his web very expertly and go to, as soon as an insect is caught here or there or anywhere, he goes right there and he binds it up with more strands, keeps it, that's his pantry, you see. He stores his food that way. Takes his meals later on. So, now what? Imagine what kind of world the spider lives in. I mean, compared to our world, you see. Imagine that. If you could communicate with the spider, and you could ask him, my dear spider, tell me about the universe. Tell me about this planet. I'm sure we would find his description to be bizarre to the maximum. Because his knowledge is coming through this web arrangement. And it's basically based on feeling. You see? So he, in his mind, he's getting these feelings and he's interpreting these feelings in a very special way according to his spider brain. We have no idea what that must be like. But that feeling, that basic, just the vibrations of the web, are translated by his brain into a whole world. And undoubtedly that world is very, very different from the world we live in. But yet again, if we compare ourselves, say, to the demigods, just compared to the demigod, to speak of Krishna, the demigods, we are like spiders. You see, we are like that. So we are, the demigods are looking at it just like we look at a spider in the web. The demigods look at us and see us. We're within the little field of our knowledge. Compared to them, our senses are just a joke, you see. The demigods, their senses, because they're angas of the Paramatma. They're angas, that means they're the limbs, the universal limbs of Lord Vishnu, who's the soul of the whole universe. So the demigods are seeing across the whole length of the universe. They move at the speed of mind from one place to another. Their perceptions are so vastly superior to ours. So they view our little human world as a joke, you see. And yet we are taking it so seriously. We are here, we have our scholars, our scientists, philosophers, writing so many books about this world. Now, if the demigods look at these books, it's just like if we could read a book written by a spider. Completely, they just laugh. It's ridiculous. So, our knowledge is very limited. We know from our Vaishnava philosophy that the senses are defective. They are imperfect. They are, therefore, subject to illusion. And because we are in illusion, we make mistakes. And yet, if we go on, as according to this system of epistemology I have just shown you, which is so self-confident, yes, we can know everything through our sense perception and our mental speculation. That is cheating. It is simply cheating. So therefore, this modern system of knowledge is just cheating. It is no exaggeration. When Srila Prabhupada would denounce modern scientists and philosophers being fools and rascals, there is, as I've tried to show you, a very good reason for that. Prabhupada was not just a cantankerous old man. As some old men, they rail against anything modern, you know. Nonsense, young kids, you don't know anything. But that was not the basis of Srila Prabhupada's criticism. And then even if we accept this epistemology of modern time and follow it, we will come to absurdity by its own rules. And I alluded to that yesterday when I was telling you about modernism versus postmodernism. I was saying the modernists, they're the ones who say there is a truth and the truth is matter. The truth, this world, this material world is real, you see? And so these concepts of progress that I've shown you, they're based on that. But then out of the same milieu, out of the same epistemology, has come a counter-movement called postmodernism, where they say there is no truth. You see, matter is by no means a definite truth. And where does this postmodernism come from? How is it supported? It's actually supported by science too, you see. And the science is this quantum physics, which I will try to explain in a simple way, so you can see how bizarre it is. So quantum physics says, okay, here's matter. Let's start with matter. But what is that matter? So they have examined it with their instruments, and they have come to the conclusion that matter is ultimately composed of quantum objects, is a technical term, which is a kind of point particle, which is so small, so tiny, and so unpredictable that it, in physical terms, it doesn't really exist. You see, it doesn't really exist. It is. I don't want to get too much into the detail, but it's. They say there's something there, but you can't really say where it is. It's too small, too uncertain. But it moves around. These things, these little tiny, tiny particles, they spin around very fast. So, their substance is there fast spinning, you see? The idea is something spins fast enough, then it kind of forms some sort of real object. But actually, it's not there. That object is not there. It's just something very small spinning very fast. And then you get many, many of these. They're spinning together. And they're forming up matter, these elements around us. Now, the interesting thing is that when you come down to this level, this quantum level, you see there's no difference between this board and the air in front of the board. It's all the same quantum energy. There's not more matter here and less matter here. So why are we seeing the board? You see, and another thing is that everything that's happening at this quantum level is all happening by chance. It's happening by chance. You see, so by chance, moment by moment, we are seeing a board here. By chance, it's an accident. It's a very interesting accident. You see, for one second by accident, there might be a board here. If all these little things are spinning around randomly. Maybe for one second the board might appear and then disappear. That would make sense to me. But the board just stays there. And why isn't there a board here? Or here? Or why don't I turn into a board suddenly? For this they have no explanation. They have no explanation. You know, it's a scientific mystery. So, you know, this is where science has ended up. This is quantum physics is the cutting edge of science today. It's the, you know, that's where all the brain power of science goes. Now, quantum physics, you know, because it is entered into this bizarre realm, and they're trying to explain it. They're trying to find answers to the questions that I've just posed. But they have already reached the limit of human sense perception. So the only thing that they have after that is speculation, this anumana. And so now, the latest quantum chapter of quantum physics is called superstring theory. I just want to explain that very briefly. And when you hear it, you will appreciate Vaishnava philosophy. You will lose all your doubts in Krishna consciousness when you hear what the scientists are contemplating. They're contemplating, and actually there's even some interesting parallel in a certain sense to our Vedic understanding. But they're contemplating that the ultimate form of reality are strings, symmetrical strings, you see, which are, you could say, maybe this is not exactly the analogy, but just like a cloth is put together by strings, so the fabric of reality is ultimately strings. But these strings, we may think of them when you first hear this, they must be something very vast, but they're extremely tiny. Extremely tiny. They're millions and millions of times smaller than these particles I was just telling you about, like protons and neutrons and things like that, these quantum objects. They're millions and millions and millions of times smaller than them. And not only that, they exist, and I'm not making this up, in the 10th and 27th dimension. That means the scientists have conceived of other dimensions of reality, mathematical dimensions. So they don't even exist in our dimension. They exist in another dimension. Now you may ask, well, you know, do they have any proof of this? They said, yes, we could prove this theory if we could construct a particle accelerator. Do you know what that is? They have one in Switzerland. It's a big ring. This one is something like, I think it's 4 kilometers across. It's a big tube. And they fire these little particles, like photons and neutrons and so on. They fire them around and then they collide. They go around, spin around faster and faster and faster and faster, and then they collide, and the scientists have these instruments to see what comes out of the collision of these particles, the little antimatter things, and then they use this to confirm their speculations. So there's one, the CERN particle accelerator in Geneva, which is, I think, something like 4 kilometers across the middle ring. But they say to prove this superstring theory, They could do it. They could do it. They just need to build a particle accelerator as big as the Milky Way, 125,000 light years across. Then they could prove this theory. So this is, you know, the superstring theory is the hot theory now. And all the brains of the universities are getting into this, which is something totally fantastic. Could never be proved. Seventh dimension. Well, you know, you might as well accept the spiritual world. If you're going to believe in that, then you might as well believe in the spiritual world. And we actually have a process to prove it. So you see, what I want to say is here, this postmodernism, which says there is no ultimate truth, has been reinforced by the fact of science coming to this point, into total insane theory. Because science, this reductionism, cannot even explain matter. I mentioned the finer things, the finer sentiments, human qualities, which are actually coming out of the soul, as I mentioned this morning. It certainly can't account for that, but this epistemology can't even account for the existence of matter. It can't even explain why there's matter. So actually, it's just ignorance. That's all it is. And that's what Prabhupada always said. And when you follow the logic of it, you come to this conclusion. It is just ignorance. These guys don't know what the hell they're talking about. But they're talking anyway. So why do people listen to them? Because along the way, because of this mechanical paradigm, this mechanistic paradigm of physical forces and numerical value, they're able to use that to produce some different machinery, you see. Actually, the scientific world is divided against itself. I mentioned quantum physics, but this is only one kind of physics. This is different from the physics of Einstein, relativity, which is in turn different from the physics of Newton, which is called the classical physics. These are the three kinds of physics that science uses. So what comes out of each of them is machinery, different kind of machinery. From Newton's physics, you get locomotives and automobiles and rockets. You see heavy kind of industrial machinery. From Einstein's relativity physics, you get atomic power, atomic energy. And from quantum physics, you get all the electronic stuff. You know, your computer is a product of quantum physics. Also, the digital tape players and all those kind of things. That's all come out of this. So, because the scientists can produce some machines, you see, then people believe them, you know. Oh, wonderful machine. So this is a kind of magic, you know. It's a kind of a magician, you know, David Copperfield or somebody. He does some wonderful thing. And people, oh, wow. And then if he would go on to give some explanation of the whole universe, people might believe him because he can do something wonderful. That's how science works. It makes some machines, and the people become addicted to this machinery because they're all in this Vaishya Shudra mentality. That's the thing. It's this Vaishya Shudra mentality which is pervading the whole world, Kali Yuga. So we all have this tendency to reduce everything down to practical facts, mechanism, anyway. And then the scientists, they supply us machines. You know, and this immediately strikes a chord. Oh, that's great. Yeah, far out. Machines. We like them. Cars. And therefore, foolish people, they give their trust over to the scientists. And then the scientists can talk all nonsense and try to explain the whole universe as a machine. But it doesn't work. It can't be explained that way. Human life cannot be explained in this mechanical way. So, as I was saying, there is now a reaction, this postmodernism, against the acceptance of matter and this mechanism and so on as being the truth. Now that has, this postmodernist movement has split into different directions. So one of them is what I was saying yesterday, this type of nihilism, you know, there is no truth. Everything is just stool, who cares? But there is another branch, and that's represented by books like this, which I picked up in the States, God, the Evidence, the Reconciliation of Faith and Reason in a Post-Secular or Post-Modern, secular is just another word for the same thing, post-secular world. So what he's a Christian. So what he's saying is that because he's saying this doesn't make any sense, you see. So what is left out? What is left out is the Word of God. You see? We need the Word of God to make sense of what we perceive and what we think. Now that's a good start. But the problem is that his Word of God, the Bible, is what brought us to this. That's the problem. I mean, it's a nice sentiment that this is alluding again to Shabda Praman, but the biblical, the Christian Bible Shabda is so meager. We explained that yesterday. Therefore, in order for it to explain, to answer questions about this world, the Christians had to ally themselves with the old obsolete science of Aristotle. The Catholic Church, you know, that was the centerpiece of European civilization before the Reformation, was Catholicism allied with Greek philosophy. You will see in France these famous cathedrals, like at Chartres, this great cathedral. That was the, you know, in that civilization, that was the shining monument of their whole culture. Just like now, maybe the, you know, Cape Canaveral, the space shuttle going up into outer space is the monument of our culture, you know, the cathedral of today. But the cathedral at Chartres in France was the symbol of the medieval Catholic civilization, which was all over Europe. And you see at Chartres, they have engraved figures. And among these figures, not only are, you know, Jesus and the saints and so on, but also Greek philosophers like Pythagoras and Aristotle. They're also engraved in the artwork of that cathedral. So this Catholic Christianity, it was, you know, gambling everything on that Greek science, that old Greek science. And then, as I told you yesterday, along came Galileo, and he pointed out faults in that science, and the whole thing collapsed. And when it collapsed, that was actually the cause of the what became known as the Renaissance. Renaissance was intellectuals and artists, everyone, you know, the creative people saying, we're not going to listen to these guys anymore. We're going to, you know, develop in our own way. And then the church tried to keep, you know, by force things in order, and then you got the Reformation, Martin Luther saying, you know, kick these guys out, don't listen to them anymore. And so that split Europe, and then there was a Protestant civilization, and then things became more and more materialistic. And this new science that was started by Galileo and then Newton and so on, this developed reductionism and has brought us down to this present day. So the actual cause of it is because the Christian scripture does not have an explanation for this world, how this world came to be, what are the laws governing this world, what is the purpose of this world. It doesn't really have an explanation for it. There's just an appeal to faith. We should have faith in the moral teachings of Jesus Christ. We should believe that he died for our sins. And if we do that, we will go to heaven. You see, so that's kindergarten theology. And so Christianity has to be, you know, it's looking for a science. So now this is the next attempt. The Christians, many of them are feeling very invigorated that science has proved itself false. And they're coming back, you know, they're trying to make a comeback. But the real progress in epistemology or knowledge, knowing the truth, will come when people take the Shabda Brahman offered by the Srimad Bhagavatam, because there we actually have a spiritual yet completely scientific explanation of this material energy, the spiritual energy, the combination in the form of this world, and the purpose. Why? So, just like I started off by saying there's more to our human experience than simply physical forces and numerical values. Like the sentiments of that little boy who was crying because a chicken was killed, or the girl who was crying because of the fish, you see. And also in the courtroom, the judge, he didn't accept this ridiculous explanation. There is a principle of justice, which is higher. So we see compassion, daya, feeling compassionate mercy for the living entities, maitri, feeling friendship for the living entities, nyaya, justice, pavitra, purity. These are actually spiritual qualities. They're qualities of the soul itself. And they manifest in our life. And they're actually fundamental. So the Bhagavata philosophy, the Bhagavata katha, the narration of the Srimad Bhagavatam, will purify our consciousness so we can directly experience these spiritual qualities. Not through the mask of the material energy, but directly. This is revelation. It means pulling back the veil of matter. And this is what Krishna calls Rajavidya, the king of knowledge. Our subject is epistemology. So we've been describing this Vaishya-Shudra epistemology. But Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is speaking of the king of knowledge. Rajavidya, Rajaguhyam, which is very confidential. Pavitram idam uttamam, the purest knowledge, because it is free from contamination of matter. Pratyashavagamam dharmam, it is realized through direct revelation, direct perception. When our consciousness becomes free of matter, then we directly experience these transcendental qualities, compassion, and so on. Finally, love of Godhead. And this is actually the foundation of human experience, consciousness, Krishna consciousness. So that we can directly experience by this process. And that is the real knowledge, that is the reality. And this process is, as we said, just bringing us in contact with dead information, dead material, sensory and mental information, which is a covering of the actual truth. So the truth is the soul and the soul's relationship with the Supreme Soul, Krishna. So that is what the Vaishnava philosophy reveals. That is what is needed in this postmodern world. So are there any questions? Yes?
Where does reasoning come from? What is
reasoning? Well, we're going to be talking about that tomorrow. That's the next session on logic. So save that for tomorrow. Any other? Yes?
Is it necessary really for the postmodernists to go as far as quantum physics and just super string philosophy to
No, no, that they don't anyway. It's just frustration. So many people, as soon as they start to hear these things, they just become disgusted. That's good. But all I wanted to do was just explain in detail why this whole edifice of so-called knowledge goes nowhere. Just so that you know. Most people don't know and don't care. Actually, this what you see today in these 1990s, the mood is a mood of very strong suspicion. They don't trust authorities. They don't trust science. They don't trust politicians. Therefore, you have so many films coming out. Last year, there was a film that came out called Conspiracy Theory. And there are many, many, there's a famous, most famous worldwide weekly television series is The X-Files, which is two FBI agents, and all they're doing is finding out how the government has been lying to the people, how science has been lying to the people, covering things up. So this is the mood today. People don't trust, they don't care about these because they don't trust this information. So it's a crisis. It's a crisis in modern culture. I remember, you know, when I was a kid, I was like that, you know. I was already like that. But then people who are mistrusting authority, mistrusting science, looking for some other explanation, they were very few. We were considered weird. But now that's like That's like in now. It's amazing to see. It's like the thing, you're hip if you don't trust anybody. You don't trust what is presented in the news and the schools and scientific institutions. But, you know, they don't have... Actually, what they're entering into is just mythology. It's a perfect setup. If we somehow can keep ISKCON together and continue to preach and distribute Srila Prabhupada's books, you can see how the whole civilization is going to fall into the lap of the Vaishnavas. Because what they're turning to, it's amazing. I just, when I was in Stockholm, bought a book published in 1998. And it was a very serious scholarly study of the UFO movement. You see, I remember also people who would speak of UFOs 20 years ago, you know, they were considered, but now it's a serious movement. It's a serious movement, and there are many, many people who believe in these UFOs, and, you know, and when you study the... Sariputta has written that book, so you can read that. But it is a kind of, very speculative, very ignorant sort of reproduction of the Vedic view of the universe with higher beings on other planets, some of them good, some of them evil, and they're opposed... fighting one another in outer space in wonderful vehicles. So it's like demigods and demons. And they're accepting this view of the world. And they're accepting that human beings are kind of, you know, just little foolish creatures caught between these powerful, super intelligent beings. So it's become a mass movement. People believing, they sincerely believe in this. You know, and there's very little proof for it either. The proof is very, very tenuous, but they believe in it. So what you can see is what is happening in the modern or post, we should say postmodern mentality, is that the furniture, the intellectual furniture is being arranged in such a way that the devotees can come in and make themselves at home. Sit down and get comfortable. Yes?
I wonder, what will they respond to this scientist when you challenge them and point out that Prabhupada and Almighty won't bring you anything, they can't bring you any actual truth? How will they respond to this?
Well, many of them, this book is representing scientists who are becoming theistic. That is a movement now. There's quite a number of scientists who are just turning away from... They're not turning away from science, but they're turning away from the idea that science can explain everything. They see more science as being something you use. Something you use for, again, practical results. But if you want to know why this world is here and why we are in this world, then some are taking to mysticism, some are taking to religion. So, you know, science is no longer a monolith. You know, it's no longer like, you know, one convinced body all agreeing on the same conclusion. It's crumbling, it's dividing. And there are still, of course, plenty of traditional atheistic scientists. But they're you know, not so confident as they used to be. They realize that science is in trouble. One of the big spokesmen of the atheistic science, he wrote a book, it was just published a couple years ago, called The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. So he was arguing that unless our society sticks, you know, with great faith and devotion to traditional materialistic science, then the demons, you know what, he's already moving in by presenting in things in that way, he's already becoming a mythologist himself. But he was saying, like, the demons are going to take over, the demons of delusion and superstition. They're going to take over our world. He was saying that, 50% of the people in the United States, they don't accept that the earth goes around the sun. You see, that's how little faith people have. Also, some 40 to 50% don't believe that men went to the moon. This is, becoming more and more prominent. And so scientists like this Carl Sagan, they're really nervous. Yes? What's the first part of your question? Is knowledge what?
Is knowledge is received and understood by perception?
It doesn't mean sense perception, physical sense perception. There is pratyaksha, that physical sense perception, but then there's what's called divya pratyaksha, divine perception, through purified senses. So Krishna says, Raja Vidya Raja Guyam, Pavitram Idam Uttamam. So he establishes that this knowledge is completely pure. And then he goes on to say, Pratyashavagamam Dharmam. So he's speaking of pure perception. You see, because we perceive, what do we perceive ultimately through? That's through the medium of consciousness. Our senses are energized by consciousness. Therefore, our senses perceive. If it wasn't for consciousness, what could we see here? We couldn't know anything. The only thing is that our material senses, they corrupt our perception. They limit our perception and corrupt our perception. So when that corruption and limitation is removed by purification, then you have pure perception. And that's what Krishna is speaking of. All right? Okay, last question.
How is, for example, this Darwinian theory? You mentioned that it's not good and like this, but all the universe people, they're completely communist.
Yeah, everywhere. Because it's the established doctrine. It's a doctrine. When you read the history of it, I mean, it came into vogue by cheating. It's amazing. You know, Darwin, he was a cautious man. He was a very quiet, reserved Englishman. So he wrote his book presenting the theory of evolution. He hesitated in his first book to say that man evolved. He didn't say that in his first book, The Origin of the Species. He didn't say man evolved. He left man out of the picture. Especially at that time, there was no proof. There were no fossils. No one had any fossils that would show man evolved. But he was saying other species, there was evolution. So that was not so bad for the Christians. You know, at least the position of man was being preserved, because the Christian position is only man has a soul anyway. So the animals are not really living creatures. So in one sense, what Darwin himself did, it wasn't all that controversial, but he inspired other people who jumped on his bandwagon. And there's this person, German scientist, called Ernst Haeckel, who is known as Darwin's bulldog. So he was the one who proposed this, what they call recapitulation, that he was the one who made these charts that show, when the fetus develops in the womb of the mother, that it goes through all the species. It starts off as a protoplasm, and then gradually becomes like a fish or a frog or, a mouse, a pig, and then finally a human being. So he's saying this proves human evolution. But the thing was, and by his preaching, he was going around everywhere preaching enthusiastically all over Europe. And by giving such kind of arguments and so-called proofs, he convinced everyone. And anyway, people were ready for atheism. There was, it was a time where atheism was to come into vogue. So they seized on this. But like Haeckel's argument for this recapitulation of the species is totally cheating. It's totally bogus. He himself drew you know, he was saying that he had taken this from, you know, actual studies of a fetus's premature birth, you know, and they studied them, and he's saying it proves evolution, but they don't look like the way he was presenting. He had done his own artwork, you know. They didn't look like that at all. But people, because they wanted to believe, they accepted it. So later on, it was all shown that this was just propaganda. So the foundations of evolution, when you want to really go into it, you know, it's built on mud, you know, it's quicksand. But it's the dogma, it's the doctrine. It's the same thing. These are demons. It's the same thing with the, you know, Indology. They say that the Aryans originated from, you know, somewhere in central Russia, and they invaded India. And the Vedas are something like, you know, the Norse myths of the Vikings. You know, these Aryans came riding in on their horses. You know, they depict them like they're some kind of Vikings, you know. And they killed all the local people, the Dravidians. And, you know, after they killed and settled there, then they, you know, had some kind of big drinking party and started, you know, they have their bards, you know, the ones who recite poems. So some drunken Viking, you know, you can imagine a helmet with these horns, he recited the Vedas. This is the this is the picture we get from the Indologists, you know, the origin of Vedic civilization. And this is a total fantasy. It is based on zero evidence, absolutely zero evidence. There is nothing at all except their own speculations. But, you know, there's a disciple of Hridayananda Maharaj, Mataji, who's studying in university in America in this field of Indology. And she's had discussions with her teachers. And she's, you know, brought this up. But what's the proof of this? And she quoted, I read something she wrote about this. She quoted them as saying, you know, proof doesn't matter. This is our doctrine. This is like our catechism, you know. This is what we believe. And we defend this doctrine. They were quite honest with her about that. And evolution is the same. It's just a dogma. But they firmly believe in it. So these people are demons. And that's the answer to your question. It's established in these universities because they're demons. They want it to be true. Because it is their argument against God. And they you know, don't want a society that's based on theistic principles because they're demons. And they don't want in the West any idea that the Vedic civilization could be, you know, very, very, very ancient and you know, superior to Western civilization. This Indology is just a trick to try to say, yeah, whatever is good in India, the Indian Vedic civilization came from the West anyway. Came from us. Okay, so we stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.